I'm Eric Rosales. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, a taxing matter. President Donald Trump makes more moves on tariffs. We're at the White House with the latest changes. Concerning trend, we take a look at some of the latest data on abortions in the U.S. from 2024. Path to sainthood. Pope Francis declares the architect of one of the world's most visited churches venerable. Plus, making preparations. We preview the Vatican's plans for Holy Week and Easter. These stories and much more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Hey, thank you, Bean, for being with us tonight. Our top story, the trade war between the U.S. and China intensifies. Beijing is no longer accepting orders of planes from Boeing and is halting purchases of aircraft equipment from other U.S. companies. President Donald Trump responded on social media calling out China, saying that they just reneged on big Boeing deal. Well, the latest, let's check in with White House correspondent Owen Jensen.
Eric, in that social media posting just before 11 o'clock this morning, President Donald Trump also said China will not take possession of fully committed to aircraft. And later, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt briefed reporters with this update straight from the president.
The president has made his position on China quite clear, although I do have an additional statement that he just shared with me in the Oval Office. The ball is in China's court. China needs to make a deal with us. We don't have to make a deal with them.
As the U.S. and China announce ever-increasing tariffs on each other's goods, along with other countermeasures to worsen their trade war, Caroline Leavitt also saying today under President Trump,
we're going to produce the cars, the ships, the chips, the airplanes, minerals, and medicines that we need right here in America at the hands of American workers.
Meanwhile, President Trump might temporarily exempt the auto industry from tariffs he previously imposed to give carmakers time to adjust supply chains. And as the trade war plays out, President Trump shows his support for farmers, writing on Truth Social, our farmers are great, but because of their greatness, they are always put on the front line with our adversaries, such as China, whenever there is a trade negotiation or, in this case, a trade war. President Trump promises them the USA will protect our farmers. Ranchers hope President Trump's tariffs will make imported beef expensive enough that Americans will turn to cattle raised at home for other hamburgers and steaks. But American ranchers will likely lose one of their biggest markets as a result of the 125% tariffs imposed by China. Representative Mikey Sherrill, a candidate for New Jersey governor, says voters there are very unhappy with the tariffs.
Because they're affecting people's day-to-day lives. I mean, here we are having an affordability crisis in New Jersey. I'm running to make sure we can drive down the cost of housing, drive down the cost of utilities, improve the broken healthcare system. And yet Donald Trump is throwing everything into chaos.
And tonight, the Trump administration very excited about this. NVIDIA will produce its artificial intelligence supercomputers in the United States for the first time. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, thank you very much, Owen. Well, outside of tariffs, another major issue defining the early days of the second Trump administration is immigration. Today, lawyers for Kilmar Abrego Garcia were in court. He's the man who lived in Maryland illegally and who was deported to El Salvador, where he's being held with violent gang members. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered that he must be returned to the United States because he was mistakenly deported. The Trump administration said that it can't force El Salvador to return him. Meanwhile, in Vermont, a Palestinian student at Columbia University has been arrested by U.S. agents during a scheduled citizenship interview. Mohsen Madawi is a permanent U.S. resident and has been active in campus protests supporting Palestinian rights. His arrest echoes the case of Mahmoud Khali, a green card holder who is also facing deportation for protesting the war in the Middle East. Joining us now to discuss these issues is Andrew Arthur, resident fellow for the Center for Immigration Studies. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Eric. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, I want to focus on the Garcia's case. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered that the administration must facilitate Garcia's return to the U.S. But as you heard, the administration says the U.S. court can't compel the president to force another country to return a prisoner. So what happens next?
That's a great question, Eric, because this is a situation in which we have a fight between the executive and the judicial branch over an issue, diplomacy, that the Constitution places squarely in the hands of the president. The court can, you know, certainly ask that he attempt to bring them back, that he uses diplomatic efforts. But we saw President Bukele of El Salvador in the Oval Office yesterday talking about how, you know, he had no way to bring this guy back to the country short of smuggling him in. And Mr. Abrego Garcia is actually a citizen of El Salvador. He's back in El Salvador. He's in the custody of his own government. So it's not entirely clear how, even if a court wants it to happen, that the administration could force that to occur.
Now, could a judge actually hold the president in contempt of court over the issue?
Sure. But, you know, to enforce that contempt order, it would require the assent of the attorney general, as I remember it from law school. And the attorney general in this case, Pam Bondi, is very unlikely to hold her, you know, to take any action against her boss. So, you know, this is one of those situations in which the court can demand something that happened and bring, you know, suasion, moral suasion to the issue. But, you know, in terms of force, there's not much that the courts can do.
And what about the other case, the two Colombian students with temporary protected status? The president says that he's fighting extremist ideology. Is that enough to detain them?
Well, when it comes to, you know, First Amendment rights, the First Amendment rights of people who are here in, you know, some sort of immigrant status, the courts have never really weighed in that heavily on what rights those individuals do have. It's commonly accepted that they don't have the full rights of citizenship, but they do have some rights. The question becomes when, you know, the expression of statements starts to impact, adversely impact, the foreign relations of the United States. In the case of Mahmoud Khalil, who is the Columbia graduate student who was arrested and is now being detained in Jenner, Louisiana, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, determined that his presence in the United States undermined the commitment of the United States to anti-Semitism and to protecting Jewish students in our country. It's a pretty strong argument. I think it's going to be very difficult to contradict that. But yeah, the real question is the Constitution is not entirely clear. Right. The courts have never really spoken that strongly. So this one's going to play out in the courts. We'll see how it comes out.
Yeah, play out in the courts and then ultimately end up possibly in the U.S. Supreme Court, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, no. I wrote just yesterday that I anticipate that Mr. Khalil's case will be headed back to the Supreme Court. I think that it's going to make some law that's going to be very effective. It's going to be the sort of case that, you know, our grandchildren, if they go to law school, will talk about 100 years from now. But it will at least answer the question. I think that a lot of what the Trump administration right now is trying to do is to try to figure out what the rules are. For years, courts of the Congress have taken a walk on this. It's time that everybody weigh in so we can figure out what's going on.
Andrew Arthur, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much, Eric. Greatly appreciate it.
In the Middle East, Hamas says that it's studying an Israeli proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza. 10 hostages would be released in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. It outlines an initial 45-day truce in Gaza, during which both sides would negotiate a permanent ceasefire. Now, that's according to Hamas officials. However, the proposal also calls for the complete disarmament of Gaza, an idea that Hamas has rejected in the past. This is Israel's first proposal to bring back hostages from Gaza since it resumed the war in March. Meanwhile, the U.S. has moved a second carrier group into the Middle East. The USS Carl Vinson joins the USS Harry S. Truman in the Arabian Sea. This comes after an overnight strike in parts of Yemen controlled by the Houthis. It suspects those strikes were carried out by the United States. The Houthis are backed by Iran, who is currently in talks with the U.S. over its nuclear program. It's the world's largest and most devastating humanitarian crisis, and it's also a conflict that is too often forgotten. Today marks the second anniversary of the Sudanese Civil War. Officials gathered in London to pledge financial support and to try and find a peaceful solution.
Very simply, we have got to persuade the warring parties to protect civilians, to let aid in and across the country, and to put peace first. And so we do need patient diplomacy.
The war between rival militaries has impacted 51 million people in the Northeast African nation. The death toll is reportedly in the tens of thousands, and famine, that is rampant. Pope Francis says that the suffering of children, women, and the vulnerable people cries out to heaven and begs us to act. He adds that he wants the warring parties to, quote, end the violence and embark on paths of dialogue and to the international community so that the help needed may be provided to the populations. For more on this, let's turn to Matt Smith, Senior Vice President for Sudan Relief Fund. Matt, great to see you. As we mentioned, there have been a number of high-level meetings today in London seeking to end this violence in Sudan. What's your take on these meetings?
Well, I think it's a start, but really this is a crisis that now in its second year has been ongoing for far too long, and the resulting devastation is almost unfathomable when you think about the humanitarian fallout. And, you know, like I said, these meetings are a start, but there's a lot of work to be done to see this resolved.
As we mentioned, the remarks Sunday by Pope Francis, what role is the Catholic Church playing in trying to find an end to this violence?
Well, the Catholic Church is on the front lines of the humanitarian response. Sudan Relief Fund is fortunate to partner with Catholic missionaries that are on the ground, on the front lines, that are working to serve those that have been forgotten by a lot of the rest of the world here. And so in conflict areas, we are, and the Catholic Church is, you know, on the front lines there as the first response to those that are in most need.
And remind our viewers again of how this conflict all started and the two warring militaries. Does any of them have support from the international community?
Well, not exactly. This war, which broke out 2 years ago today, is really between the Rapid Support Forces, a rebel-backed militia, and the Sudanese Armed Forces, which was the existing Sudanese government-backed military at the time. And this war has resulted in utter devastation. It started in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, but quickly spread all across the country. And so now, really, there's not been a part of Sudan that has been spared from this fighting. And there is not really an end in sight as I see it.
Yeah, well, that was going to go to my next question of how do you see this all playing out, Matt? I mean, this cannot continue, correct?
It can't. And, you know, this is the world's greatest humanitarian crisis right now. And with so many needs all across the world, it can be hard to have international attention and paid to this particular crisis, but it's what's needed right now at this moment.
Well, God bless you and the work that you're doing, Matt.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And, you know, with 13 million people displaced, over 25 million people in need of food, you know, the needs are great. And so it's in that space that we try to step in and solve those needs.
Well, thank you so much. Matt Smith, Senior Vice President for the Sudan Relief Fund. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Eric.
We still have a lot more to come on EWTN News Nightly, including frozen funds. The Trump administration announced it's holding billions of dollars from Harvard University, the reason why and how the university is responding. And he designed one of the most beautiful churches in the world. Now he's one step closer to canonization. Hear why the Holy Father declared him venerable. Welcome back. The Trump administration is freezing more than $2 billion in federal funding for Harvard. The move comes after the Ivy League university failed to comply with changes demanded by the administration. The school president released a statement saying the university will not surrender its independence or constitutional rights. One policy change by the White House calls on each academic department to ensure that it's providing diverse viewpoints. A new study says that the number of abortions in America is on the rise. The findings are from the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute. They estimate that last year there were 1.04 million abortions. That's a rise of about 1%. The report also says last year fewer people crossed state lines to obtain abortions. Multiple studies have found that since the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022, the number of abortions in the U.S. has risen. 12 states have abortion bans with limited exceptions. 4 more have bans that kick in after about 6 weeks. A new op-ed piece says President Donald Trump has an opportunity to remind the country that Christ is King. Writing in the Daily Signal, co-authors Kevin Roberts and William Wolfe say, in part, quote, under both Presidents Barack Obama and Joe Biden, the U.S. government consistently and aggressively prioritized advancing LGBT ideology and other progressive social issues ahead of religious freedom. President Donald Trump has the opportunity to put a stop to this madness, help return Christianity to its proper pride of place in our policies, and pave the way for the national celebration of the 2000th anniversary of the resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in 2033. Joining us now is the author himself, Dr. Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation. First question for you, Dr. Roberts, why did you pen this op-ed now?
Because I think it's important as we are on the brink of Easter during Holy Week to encourage people of all faith, whether they're Christians like me or Jews or Muslims, to speak about their faith. This is an opportunity here in the United States, not just for political and policy-making success, but more importantly, for the revitalization of our faith as individuals and also as a country. If we get that right, Eric, then we're going to get the politics and the policymaking right as well.
Well, what good things have you seen the president do, and what do you think he still needs to do?
He's done two things exceptionally well thus far. The first is he's been unabashed about speaking about America's religious roots. Obviously, with our religious pluralism, President Trump is sort of the perfect person to talk about that. And the reason we need that is because we've seen religious institutions, whether they be schools or churches or associations, really become very muted. I mean, in some cases, I would even say that there's a certain cowardice, a certain reticence about speaking out in public. And so President Trump using the bully pulpit, I believe, will encourage those religious leaders and individuals to speak more openly about this. But the second thing that he's done, and it's both in the State Department and across the administration and other agencies, is end the Obama-Biden era practice of running roughshod over religious liberty. It's not that we want to establish one particular religion as the official one, obviously. It's that we, just as people of faith, want to be able to do more than just have private religious thoughts. We actually want to live out our faith in the public square. And so those policies have been very good. Ultimately, to answer your question about what the administration needs to do, they just need to continue to do that for the next 3.5 years. That is, to honor publicly and in policy the religious freedom that we have, not just here in the United States, but as I point out in the op-ed, they also need to do that on behalf of Christians around the world, particularly in the Middle East.
Yeah, staying with policy reforms now, you said that these reforms should actually be paired with the great cultural awakening. How might that awakening come in an age where we're seeing a growing secularism out there in the world, are we not?
That awakening is going to come not from politics and from policy. It's going to come from each of us. That's the point that I try to make in the op-ed, that, you know, it's easy for us to sit back and say, well, I go to Mass as a Catholic or church as a Protestant or the synagogue as a Jew, and this problem is someone else's. No, this problem is ours. In other words, having a lot of friends who are policymakers and elected officials, we can make their jobs easier as it relates to policymaking if we live out our respective faiths with zeal, with a real passion, with a persuasiveness to bring people to the truth. I think that when President Trump talks about this being the golden age of America, it isn't just because we're going to get the economy right. It isn't just because we're going to right-size Washington. Most importantly, it's going to be because each of us plays a role in revitalizing the religious institutions in our lives and our communities.
Well, the time is to speak up now. Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Kevin Roberts, president of Heritage Foundation. Thanks again.
Pleasure is mine. Take care.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Reaching New Heights. Pope Francis advances the cause for sainthood for the architect of one of the world's most well-known cathedrals. Plus, we'll take a closer look at the Vatican's plans for Holy Week and Easter. Francis has brought the architect of Barcelona's iconic Sagrada Familia Basilica one step closer to sainthood. The Holy Father formally declared that Antoni Gaudí venerable after recognizing his heroic virtue. Two miracles attributed to his intercession are now required for his canonization. The basilica is one of the most visited churches in the world and is still under construction more than 140 years after work began. The White House plans a series of events to mark Holy Week. Jenny Korn, the director of the Faith Office, shares with the agenda, that is, with White House correspondent Owen Jensen.
I know there's some big events planned. At least I hear that's what's going on. I haven't seen the list, so I'm hoping you can provide the list of events for Holy Week taking place here at the White House.
The president, as you said, he released a proclamation on Palm Sunday to make sure that we were able to observe it for all of the Holy Week. Then presidential message, video messages will be going out. Tomorrow there will be an Easter, pre-Easter dinner with faith leaders where there'll be worship and prayer. And then on Thursday we're going to have a White House staff pre-Easter service as well for the whole staff so that we can come together, pray, and worship. So we're very excited that here at the White House we are honoring Easter in the way it is supposed to be observed.
Korn says the main focus of the White House Faith Office is religious freedom. You can watch her full interview online. And finally tonight, preparations are well underway at the Vatican for the most important time of the year, the resurrection of Christ and Easter Sunday. And meticulous care, that is being put to everything from the flowers that will decorate St. Peter's Square to the chairs for the faithful inside the Basilica. EWTN Vatican journalist Magdalena Wolinska-Reedy has more.
Preparations for Easter are already in the final stretch. The olive trees that were set up for the Palm Sunday Mass are now giving space to thousands of colorful flowers, traditionally donated to the Pope by Holland, to decorate St. Peter Square for the Day of the Resurrection.
The Pope and the Vatican, all ceremonies of Holy Week attract many, and this has been so for centuries. In the 19th century, many non-Catholics participated in the rites of Holy Week because of their magnificent beauty and the impression they make.
A special entity hidden in the courtyards of the Apostolic Palace, the Apostolic Floreria has the responsibility of overseeing all logistical preparations inside the Basilica and on St. Peter's Square. The cardinal chairs are being cleaned, the fabrics for the solemn ceremonies ironed. Everything is getting its finishing touch. Holy Week is the most important time of the liturgical year, and with the ongoing Jubilee of Hope, the situation becomes even more challenging.
The atmosphere during these days is always that of expectation. It's very special. We know that for us, who as a service have to accomplish the preparation of all the ceremonies, it is a very busy year. There are 54 Jubilee ceremonies in addition to ordinary ones, like Easter. So we have to prepare everything very well.
Rows of seats around Bernini's baldacchino are already waiting for the Christmas on Thursday morning, during which the traditional blessing of the oils and the consecration of the chrism will take place, and the Mass of the Lord's Supper later in the evening. On Friday evening, the traditional way of the cross in the Colosseum with the meditations written personally by Pope Francis will attract thousands of pilgrims and Romans. The splendid St. Peter's Basilica, with its cathedral fresh from restoration, will welcome thousands of faithful on Saturday night again for the Easter Vigil Mass.
This beauty of the Basilica, in my opinion, is also a beautiful way in which we can prepare for Easter. At Easter, we clean the house, we get it ready, we invite people we love, and I believe this is a beautiful way, external, yes, but one that still speaks of an inner disposition. The desire to be reconciled with everyone, the desire to start anew.
For the first time in his 12-year pontificate, Pope Francis is unlikely to preside over the Triduum celebrations this year as he continues to recover following his recent hospitalization. However, the crowds who will gather in St. Peter's Square on Easter Sunday will continue to pray for him and for peace in the world. In Rome, Magdalena Wolinska-Reedy, EWTN News Nightly.
Wow, what a beautiful celebration. We want to thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Eric Rosales. Have yourself a good night. God bless y buena suerte.